Today on the Inside Flap.
Because, you know, everything's so chaotic, yes. and I don't have that much control in real life. And so it's lovely to be, you know, to be the puppeteer in my working life. And they do, Nabokov called his characters his galley slaves. And I'm really on board with that. As a book writer. I guess my favorite, though, from that era would be Guns N' Roses.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. For sure. Right. Well, Axl Rose.
You don't agree.
Well, I don't want to go to the Great Plains, Kansas in 1870.
No, it sounds like... Oh,
you don't want to go there in 2019.
let alone.
The Inside Flap is available on demand every week on iTunes, Stitcher, the Google Play Store, and around the world on theinsideflap.com.
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. My name is Dave Medicus. Thank you so much for joining us. Seated across the table from me, to my right, is Andrew Dowd.
Hello, listeners. Welcome back.
And to my left is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy, indeed.
Trying that one out.
How's that one feel?
It's okay.
You shouldn't need to be wearing a cowboy hat with that one, but I don't know.
Well, we're in the West.
Yeah, that's true. We are in lovely, sunny Colorado. Thank you so much for joining us. We are...
The Inside Flap.
So, if you are new to the show, welcome. Thanks for checking us out. Every week, Andrew, Laura, and myself recommend a book to read. We talk to an author. This week... Louise Candlish.
Mm-hmm.
Looking forward to playing that interview that Laura and I did this morning. And we spotlight an audiobook of the week. I did a little bad grammar there.
Yeah, I wasn't sure where that was going.
And.
Okay.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, listen, you want to follow us? Go ahead and follow us. Follow us on Twitter. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, at The Inside Flap. Those sites are all updated every day, or you can just go to our website.
Every day.
Almost every day. Practically every day. 75% of the days, I would say. Or, you know what, just go to our website, theinsideflap.com, where you can listen to all of our episodes right there. So, as we mentioned, we do have an episode for you tonight.
And I heard an interesting plug the other day, but if you know some people that are technically challenged... help them to subscribe to the podcast.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes, please do. You know, here's a good trick. Next time, you know, you're over at your, your parents' house, your son's house, your sister-in-law's house, your evil stepmother's house, wherever house you seem to find yourself in, mm-hmm. See a phone lying around. Pick that cell phone up. Pretty much everybody has some kind of podcast app. You know, if they don't, go ahead and download it. Search The Inside Flap and click subscribe. There's a good way for us to get some subscribers and for your evil stepmother to get some new listening material.
Now, what I found is I've got some family members and relatives
mm-hmm.
that I cannot get off the phone.
Ah.
And so what I've done is I've subscribed them to The Inside Flap. And then I find they don't call me quite
often. Because they know what's going on in your
often.
Life.
And I've had one quote, which
That's
is,
funny.
Andrew, we spend so much time with you listening to The Inside Flap that we really don't feel the need to come and spend any time with you.
Oh. Perfect. Wow. So, that's a win-win situation.
That's kind of an
that's
ouch,
awesome.
Though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Little dig there.
Well, it depends on the relative.
It depends. Yeah.
Anyway, yes, we do. Coming up on the show tonight, we have a great conversation with Louise Candlish. Her new book is called Those People. You can get it right now. As we're recording, this is June 11th. Just came out today here in the U.S.
Great.
So go ahead and get that. It's called Those People. I'll be recommending that book for you later on. It is excellent. He's also the author of the bestseller Our House, winner of the British Book Awards 2019 Crime and Thriller Book of the Year.
Wow.
And even more notable, our audiobook of the week this week.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Yep.
Looking forward to that.
That's right. So I'll talk to you about Our House later on. All right, guys. So... started a big, big summer project. I was telling you guys about it last week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Andrew, we are tearing apart the backyard. He was just out back inspecting the work that I had done with the bulldozer out there. I guess you call it a skid steer, kind of a mini bulldozer.
Little bobcat.
Yeah. Now, apparently, Andrew, I don't know if you knew this, but our yard was actually featured in an outdoors magazine at one point.
I have a copy of it.
I think you have. You had mentioned that before. Mm-hmm. And it's, if you had seen the yard now or before Dave started, you know, playing around with his little little machine back there, it is hard to imagine that that could have been featured. Mm-hmm.
Incredibly hard. Yeah. And now, when we bought the home, it was incredibly hard to imagine.
Yeah, it's about 2/3 of an acre. Now, when we bought it, it had we've been here about 4 years, years.
Honestly,
now.
Honestly, it seems like 2/3. It's just a third.
Is it 1/3 of an acre?
That's all it is. That's seems the bigger. Sad part because it seems huge.
And jammed into this 1/3 of an acre, they had two big ponds. Yep. One with a big waterfall feature, a couple of bridges. There were hilly little gardens everywhere, trees all over the place, flower beds, bushes. Mm-hmm. And so over the years, and as several owners have owned the house, the only magazine that our backyard would appear in would have been a horror magazine. Mm. So when we moved in, the pond in the back was a mosquito-infested swamp. Mm-hmm. The pond directly behind the house was ringed entirely by waist-high flag lilies everywhere, which it turns out are the watch list for Colorado for being a noxious weed species. Hmm. Because I just looked that up last mm-hmm. night, and it was entirely around the
they're
whole
in most states, I pond. Think, they're that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everything else was completely overrun. Ivy all over the place. Snakes. There was grass. Raccoons. What else have we seen? Rabbits all over the place.
Yeah.
There used to be grass in the backyard until we moved in with our dog, Nelson, who which we did not know until we moved here. It turns out to be quite a digger. And within a couple weeks, the grass was torn up. Just a complete disaster. So after a couple of years of fixing the inside of the house, it's time to tackle the back.
Now, I like to refer to the dog as Admiral Nelson.
That's like right. That. Yeah. Okay. I like the Admiral. The Admiral.
Yeah. He prefers that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's not too many digging that necessary at sea.
And he's also a famous British Admiral that helped to take the British Navy from coal to oil-based ships and completely change the balance of power in the world. Hmm.
And you can hear all about that on Andrew's other podcast, History in the Making, featuring Andrew Dowd. So we went ahead.
So Dave's tired.
Andrew helped me rent. I'm incredibly tired. Andrew helped me rent out a skid steer, this mini bulldozer type deal. Now, the skid steer, Andrew, you've had some experience with it. And now you actually were nice enough to take a sick day last Friday. I don't know if anyone from your work is listening.
Well, actually, technically, I did not take a sick day. I was working from home.
That's true. That's true. He came over and
set my computer up. You know, mm-hmm. I was logged onto the network. I attended, you know, 3 or 4 conference calls throughout the day.
Yes, you did.
And it is a little annoying having to go back and forth. But, you know, I'll say the week, exactly 1 week ago, I had worked until 4 a.m.
Ooh.
I mean, basically, I'd, you know, probably worked.
Oh, like, to launch the.
Yeah, to launch the product. So, you know, I don't feel too guilty. Yeah. I figure you got to balance things out a little bit.
I used to have to do that. Yeah.
Well, somebody had to show me how to use this thing because he runs around the backyard with it a little bit, motors mm-hmm. around, and he says, "All right, Dave, go ahead, hop in there and take it for a little spin." So I get in there and I sit in the bucket seat there, and now there are two joysticks right in front of me. And, you know, I turned it on and I figure out, well, you push the joysticks forward and the skid steer goes forward. You pull them back, it goes back. So then I'm trying to turn and Andrew looks at me with really just disgust in his face and in his voice. And like, what are you, it's like a tank. You just drive it like a tank. Now, having not been at the Battle of Verdun, I had no idea how to drive a tank. I don't know why that was your point of reference to tell me how to drive this skid steer. But then I realized if you push one joystick forward and one joystick back, then it starts spinning.
That's like a tank?
If that makes any sense.
Okay.
Have you ever driven a tank?
Is that what
before?
You meant by that's like a tank?
Exactly. So basically what happens with the tank is, I mean, the treads are independently operated.
Okay.
The same with the skid steer. And basically you can go forward on both sides, you can go backwards on both sides, or you can reverse it so that you can basically spin in either direction.
Well, yeah. Huh. Also, something else he taught us in his other podcast. I didn't. That's true. That was episode 4.
How to drive tanks, a tank.
How to drive a tank. So finally, I figured it out, and I'm realizing as I'm wheeling around the backyard that I have driven something like this before. Many years ago, when I worked at a lumber company, Allstate Lumber Company in Maryland, Lutherville, Maryland, and I had to. Every once in a while, you'd have to take this little bobcat and scoop up some sand. So if a customer wanted some sand for whatever reason, one scoop was a quarter of a ton, and you'd drop a load into the back of their pickup truck. Well, I'll never forget this one time. It was like the first time I'd ever used it.
I don't know if I've heard this one.
And I take the bobcat, and now I'm not a great driver. I'm not very mechanically inclined. Andrew.
So Dave has a long history of being of being accident prone. Yes. I mean, a long, long history.
Yes.
You're well documented on the show. So I scoop up the scoop, quarter ton of sand, and the guy's got his pickup truck there.
Oh, no.
And I kind of swivel around, and I have the bucket up. Now, also on these levers, if you push to the side, one lever operates the bucket going up and down, and the other operates the bucket, dumping it and undumping it. Right now, undump it, but folds it back, whatever. So I get the bucket in position, and the bucket is all the way because I don't want to hit the guy's truck. So I've got the bucket way high up in the air, well away from where his truck is. Now I was lined up in position. Now, I go to lower the bucket, but instead of lowering the bucket, I use the wrong joystick, and I unload a quarter ton of sand from about 20 feet up in the air, and it all hits the back of his pickup truck. Where this thing bounces up and down like it's a trampoline, and the guy is just standing there staring darts at me like, what have you just
done? I think
you owe me a new pair of shocks. But, of course, being the stand-up guy that I am, I just swiveled around and drove to the back of the yard and waited to hear him come running for me.
Oh, my
but,
goodness.
You know, nothing ever came out of that. So I guess his shocks worked after that.
Sometimes words just aren't adequate.
So had a lot of fun playing around with that. Now, because they had these two pond features there in our backyard.
I'm still thinking about that.
Yeah, this used to be. I mean, it was just, it bounced up like
you're
the
lucky
back
that
of his,
was the days before the Yelp reviews.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. Like the back of his truck could have come over and like leaped the front of his truck. It was bouncing
it
up.
It was
so
that
high.
Bad?
I mean, it bounced. It bounced.
Wow.
It bounced like a quarter off of a young GI's
what?
Well made bed.
Okay.
All right, so
episode
going around
13 of
anyway,
Andrew's
yes,
podcast.
That's right. How to make a bed. Now, there are so many rocks in the backyard because of these pond features and all the flower beds and everything. They use rocks to outline these beds. After digging up these rocks, what I would do is I take the little skid steer, drive over to these rocks that are embedded in the ground, kind of push and pull at them with the bucket to break them up a little bit. And I have to hop off the machine, grab these rocks. And these rocks aren't small. You know, you've seen these rocks, Andrew. These are like a foot to 2 feet in diameter or diameter. These are big, heavy rocks.
I'd say the rocks probably range from, 20 to 80 pounds.
Yeah, for easily.
And most of them are probably, closer to somewhere in the middle
50,
there.
Yeah. 40, 50.
So what I would do is hop off, I'd throw the rocks into the bucket, drive to the other end of the yard, dump all the rocks there, and then go back and get some more rocks. So I repeated this approximately 732 times.
That's true.
Ended up on the side of, now you saw the wall of rocks that I have back there right now, right? I would say it's probably about 5 feet high, 15 feet wide, and 25 feet long. Is that fair?
I think it was a little higher than 5 foot, because I think it was... Before you started taking them down,
right.
I feel like it was like
it might have
height.
Been. Actually, you're probably right. It probably
it's
is.
A little above 5 feet.
Literally thousands of rocks. Yeah. Each one I've lifted and put into the front end loader and driven across and dumped. Now there's a problem. The problem is that in grading out this yard, We now have a 3-foot-tall dirt wall in the middle of the backyard that runs the entire length of the wall.
Sounds lovely.
So if we just leave it here, obviously the rain's going to wash it out, and we're going to be left with a big muddy mess.
A big problem, actually.
So solution, we're going to build we've got all these rocks. We're going to build a nice little retaining wall to hold up this wall.
Mm-hmm.
Problem. All these rocks that have been embedded in the ground for years are completely mud-covered and look like, they look like garbage. Mm-hmm. So
rubble. They look like building rubble.
Yeah.
So technically, I've got to point out, it is not a retaining wall. This is going to be a dry stack stone wall.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah.
Quite different from retaining wall.
Yes. Now,
of course, the difference is there's much less hydrostatic pressure with a dry stack wall than there would be if it was a true retaining wall.
That's a good point, yeah. Andrew. I like that.
That's from episode 4 of Andrew's other podcast, Andrew on the House.
Build things.
How to build a retaining wall.
But I do have to insert a joke here is... I used to read books all the time on building walls,
mm-hmm.
and my wife would read books on tearing them down.
Ah.
Yes, indeed. So, of course, taking a hose to these rocks isn't going to do anything. So now I got to go rent a pressure washer from Home Depot. So I go over to Home Depot, and of course, it's really busy there like it always is. And they got one kid, like this 17-year-old kid working behind the counter.
The young Dave Medicus.
From Allstate, yeah.
Yeah.
Who really doesn't
care.
Could care less about being there. So I get to the front of the line finally, and this is what I really can't stand. This is what really annoys me. Anytime you're in any kind of store where you need a little customer service from someone behind the counter,
mm-hmm.
all I want is I literally start to say the words, yes, I'd like to rent a pressure washer. And before I got the word pressure out of my mouth, the phone rings.
Oh, Home Depot is bad about that.
What does he do?
Yeah.
Picks up the phone.
Yeah.
Now I'm thinking maybe he's just going to say, excuse me, I'm with the customer. I'll help you in 1 second. No, he's got to go through the whole litany. This guy's got to, he wants to rent something and it's not available this day. And we only have 2 in the yard. Let me check with this other guy. And it's 10 minutes and I'm standing right in front of him.
That's a strange thing.
It drives me nuts. If you are in the store, you take precedent over any phone call that's being made.
So for me, I have a point, is I like to finish one conversation at a time,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it isn't fair to you.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not.
No.
And the person who got out of their house and drove there.
Got out of their house, drove there, is taking their time.
Ready to buy. Also.
For all he knows, I'm taking a day off of work.
Well, also ready to buy.
Ready to buy.
Like for me, if I want to sell stuff, I'm going to help the person who's got their card in hand.
Yeah.
Well, and business-wise, mathematically, you would refer to that. You could do Black-Scholes option modeling, as we learned in grad school. But it comes down to what is the probability that the customer on the phone versus the one that's standing in front of you is going to put cash in the register?
See, that's right. Is my point.
Absolutely true. Mm-hmm. This guy.
How to earn money 101.
And where else am I? What am I going to do? What am I going to drive to another Home Depot, get another pressure washer? I'm already there. So yeah, I'm going to give him the money.
Yeah.
Act like
you've got
you
a bird
it.
In the hand.
So of course I take the first pressure washer doesn't work. When I get it back to the house, I got to go back to the Home Depot, get a new nozzle, get a new thing.
I was in my little office
with customer service.
I thought you were hurt, and I came like trotting out of my office because of the distress in your voice and the level of upsetness that you were.
When I was talking to the manufacturer in Iowa.
Yeah. Is that what you were doing?
Yeah. Plug it in. Are you plugged into an extension cord? Have you turned it off and turned it back on again?
Oh, really? They asked that?
No.
Oh.
He did tell me if it was plugged. He did ask me if it was
plugged in.
Yeah.
That's funny. Mm-hmm.
So in the tech world, there's something referred to as a ID10T error. Now, are you familiar with that?
No, I am not.
Here we go. We're going to do a little experiment.
Uh-oh.
ID10.
He's going to draw it out.
Folks, try this at home.
This is an audio podcast.
Is this like pen 15?
But ID10T error.
Okay. Yes.
And
Go ahead, try that one out.
Let me see it.
Try that one at home.
I'm a dummy. Let me see
Try that one at phone at home.
Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead and try that one.
Thank you.
That's in the tech world. That's what we call an ID10T error.
I like that.
You calling me an idiot?
I'm no comment.
So yeah, had to go back. Same guy, same slack jawed yokel back at the Home Depot. No line this time, but I was like, yeah, it's not working. Well, I'll give you another one. I don't want another one. Just give me, let me try another gun. He gave me another gun, another nozzle. Finally got it working, but now, of course, I'm washing, hand washing.
Yeah, this is weird that you did this today. I thought it was a little weird.
This huge wall of rocks, I'm now having to
hand washing every rock.
Thousands of rocks. Hand washing them, putting them back. Well,
let's be real.
There's thousands of rocks in that pile.
That's true. That's true.
Well, now we need hundreds of rocks for the wall. So I'm hand washing hundreds of rocks, putting them in the front end loader and dumping them over by where the wall is so I can start making my wall. So that was my day today.
Couldn't you count on the rain to just wash the rocks off?
I don't think it would have gotten
these,
it.
These yeah. rocks have been underground.
Thought of that.
I couldn't have even taken a hose.
The rocks were kind of buried in the earth from years and years, okay. like 30 years of being just sitting there.
Neglect. Yeah. Even with the pressure washer, I had to go over these rocks a couple of times, some of them, to really scrape. I was like, every single rock looked black until I took the pressure washer and told, oh, that's
it looked like building rubble. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but it turned out all right, and that's my summer so far.
It's great.
Yeah, a lot of fun. Laura, how was your week?
Oh, good. I feel bad about you and all the work you're doing. There's some guilt there.
It'll only take two summers to finish this one. It took two summers to finish the kitchen job, so.
Okay.
So, Laura, I wouldn't feel guilty.
Really?
I mean, well, one, think of it this way. If you'd have brought a contractor in to do a week's worth of backbreaking work.
Yeah.
I mean, I honestly think you would have spent $10,000 or $12,000.
We couldn't have afforded it.
If you could have found somebody to basically do that kind of work.
It would have been our whole budget.
Yeah. So, I mean, look at the fact you probably saved about $10,000 having Dave slave away out there. Mm-hmm. So actually,
makes you feel better.
Should put a big smile on
your
face.
That's true.
Yeah.
I was earning good money, you know, doing my work.
Maybe we need to put out some bonus episodes of the podcast and have listeners pay for them.
Oh, we're good.
Hey, by the way, tell a friend if you're listening to us right now. Tell a friend. This is a book podcast. We'll get to the books in a little bit.
I went for a walk the other day, and there were some cricket players. There's a cricket match actually going on at the park that I walk at.
Oh.
Got some cricket. Not quite that kind of cricket. They were pretty quiet though. And so they were like all dressed in cricket outfits. They practice up there, but this was a tournament, I believe.
Oh, did they have like the clean white outfits?
They actually were red and green. So one team was in red and white. The other team was in green and white. Mm. And they had like an officials table and all the other kinds of things. And a cricket ball came at me way past.
What is that? I don't know what a cricket, is that like a lacrosse ball?
It's like a, felt like a softball mixed with a polo ball maybe or something like that.
So I don't know that it was a true cricket ball because I think true cricket balls are like almost like completely solid.
Might have been solid. It was solid.
Because cricket balls are not, you do not want to get hit with one of those.
It's heavy. It's a very heavy ball is what I would say. And on that note, that explains where I'm going with this. So this cricket ball comes lumbering up to me and it's heavy. So it was kind of rolling.
Yeah.
And I see the cricket player. I mean, I'm not very good with distances, but he's a ways off and he sees me.
Right.
Oh, this nice lady's going to bring, you know, give me this cricket ball. I motion. I'm like, hey, guys, I've got this.
I got this. I'm
raise my hand in the air like, yep, I'm your gal. I'm going to get this ball. So I pick the ball up. And then, like Andrew said, it is heavier than I thought it would be.
Uh-oh.
And I haven't thrown a ball in a very long time.
Well, you lack the necessary rudimentary skills of ball throwing.
I do.
I didn't pass that down to our daughter.
I do.
Unfortunately. But yes, ball throwing skills, not in your
skill set. So I raised my first instinct was to throw overhand. And I raise my arm up and I go to throw and I'm thinking, I can't make it to this guy. And the whole cricket team
they're all watching now.
Is turned and stared, even the officials at the little card table.
No.
So I go to throw that way and then I put my hand down and the player's just standing there. And like he sees me. I don't know if he realizes,
maybe he thinks you're going to steal the ball now at this point.
Like this lady is something's wrong. So then I go and I throw it underhanded and I throw it underhanded as hard as I can and it still doesn't get to him. It goes up in the air, goes down really quick and then kind of bobbles towards him. And this guy didn't give me a wave, didn't give me a thank you, gave me a shake of the head, looked very disappointed at me and walked away with the ball.
Oh, that is so embarrassing.
And then I go around this park twice. The next time, I just avoided the little cricket game that was going on. Yes, Andrew.
So I've looked it up, but the main difference, however, is that the ball in cricket is harder and heavier in weight than an American baseball.
So it definitely wasn't like a baseball.
So the legal weight for a baseball is between 5 and 5.25 ounces, and the legal weight for a cricket ball is between 5.5 and 5.8 ounces. And for you listeners over the pond, that's 142 to 149 grams versus 156 and 164 grams. But it is harder and heavier than an American baseball. And an American hardball is mm-hmm. You do not want to get hit with one of those.
No.
People get killed by those.
Yeah.
It happens every year in Little League and mm-hmm. things like that, too. So
Owen Meany. Prayer for Owen Meany. That's how his mother died.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
And that's mm-hmm. real life. It happens. I mean, yeah. We've lived in places where that's happened before, too. But for a cricket ball to be harder and heavier than a baseball.
Than a baseball.
You know, and I would say that speaks to the people playing cricket at this park. Mm-hmm. They really, I mean,
they were serious.
Yeah.
They were serious about it. The ball, I will say the ball came in no danger of hitting me because it was just rolling towards me quickly. But if I had been walking a little closer to them, it might have. That's why I avoided it. Part of the reason I avoided it. And then I also felt embarrassed about my weak arms.
That reminds me of this book called Netherland. It's the only book I've ever read about cricket.
Huh.
It's a novel by Joseph O'Neill, and it had like rave reviews. Mm-hmm. So I went and picked it up, and I remember being on like a long plane ride stuck, and this was the only book I had.
That's a risk.
It put me to sleep. It was terrible, awful. I remember I was like struggling to keep my eyes open and read this book because it was gotten so
cricket?
Many good reviews.
Was it fiction or nonfiction?
It's fiction. It's Netherland. 2008 is a novel by Joseph O'Neill. Hmm. Concerns the life of a Dutchman living in New York in the wake of the September 11th attacks, who takes up cricket and starts playing at the Staten Island Cricket Club. It is terrible.
Aww.
In this reviewer's opinion.
So, Inside Flap listeners, we're going to give you the pledge of quality that we will never mislead you with a review.
That's right.
If you follow our recommendations,
that's right.
You will not get stuck in a plane.
With a boring cricket book.
God,
with
the wrong, the worst.
We will point you to the right book about
really
cricket.
Funny.
That's right.
What about you, Andrew? See any cricket players this week?
No. And so, I guess a few interesting things mm-hmm. is, so yesterday we had to take the dogs to the vet. And so
everything okay?
Well, yeah, yes and no. I mean, so generally they hadn't been there in a year.
Oh.
And so our one dog, Rex, he was probably up to like 120,
he's a big boy.
130 pounds. Now he's probably lost 10 or 15 pounds.
Oh, that's good.
And so we took him to the vet, and that's one of the things is now he is on.
I just want to point out, you guys are both drinking from the same water glass.
But, well, I took one sip.
What?
I took one sip, and now I'm, that's why I'm now leaning.
Away.
That's why I'm now leaning.
You're trying to indicate to
I thought it was maybe because right I didn't side. Put deodorant on after working in the yard all day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Rex.
Yep. So basically Rex is now on prescription dog food.
Oh, to lose some weight?
To basically lose weight. And so Rex needs to lose about 20 pounds.
That's a lot.
And he's already lost 15. Yeah.
Have you counted all your chickens in the coop? Well, is it possible he got in there?
And the dogs actually get along fine with the chickens. So we can leave them all in the yard and it's all one big happy menagerie.
Admiral
of,
Nelson
for now.
Well, I think it's going to be fun.
When that dog's running in the backyard, he's got chicken feathers coming out of his snout. You'll know
it's the red-tailed hawk we have to watch out for.
Yeah.
So there's that, and then there's a little spot in his ear, and I'm like, ask the vet, what can you check that out?
Uh oh.
And of course, it turned out that it's a hot spot, and so they went back. Says, let's go back and we'll take a look at it.
What
the
heck's a hot spot?
It's like an inflammation area.
Okay.
And so basically, she came back, 15 minutes later, and they had shaved off half of his head.
Oh, Rex.
So we had to get like topical antibiotics. We had to go get one of those silly cones to put on his head. And I tell you, he is just
the cone of shame.
He's
miserable.
Miserable. I mean,
he's on a diet. He's got a cone. His head's shaved. Goofy.
Get three shots.
Oh, it sounds like Andrew in middle school.
Yeah, no,
a young Andrew.
No comment there. And then, so that's fine. And so Raven, our little dog, who's a Cavapoo, King Charles Cavalier Poodle Mix. So she was fine, except that they're like, we've got to do some dental work on her.
Oh.
And so just before the show, I just got the estimate. And at the, you know, low estimate, $675 for dental work.
Wow.
At the high estimate, $800 for, you know, for canine
cleaning,
cleaning, maybe some extractions, things like that.
We'll be putting up those bonus episodes. So take a look at that.
Going to set up a GoFundMe site to pay for vet bills. But, you know, so inside of a month, basically, we'll probably be spending $1,200,
$1,500 on dogs.
On vet bills. And, you know, it happens. I pulled up my medical HSA card at the veterinarian, and my wife is like, you can't use that. And it was wishful thinking. I wanted to try it. And if it had worked, you know,
they do sell health insurance for pets.
And they do, but
always seems like, I don't know why. It just seems like a waste.
But we're, Katie goes in for a medical procedure Friday.
That's right. On Friday.
And okay. So we are gearing up for, and she will not be,
she's not able to lift anything probably for a couple weeks, right? She walk upstairs?
Two to six weeks. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think once she gets upstairs, she's going to stay up there for like the next month.
Probably.
Those are my expectations. Yeah. But, you know, we're kind of gearing up for all that and gearing up for summer camp for the kids, buying all this like gear.
Oh, gear.
Yeah, the kids' summer camp.
What kind of gear?
So, sleeping bags.
Cricket gear. You guys taking up cricket?
No,
not with how hard those balls are. So Andrew would not let that
sleeping
happen.
Sleeping bags. Okay. Inflatable mattresses.
Wait, I thought they had... Wait, they're tenting?
Well, and so what they do in this camp is they actually do two overnight trips with real tents. So they're in cabins and things like that, but there's actual two hiking overnight trips to campsites. So
that's fun. That's a great experience.
Yeah, so I have to gear them up for all that. And we've got about 3 weeks before they go. But part of it is I could spend, if you go to REI or whatever, I could spend thousands of dollars buying this stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you get it on Amazon?
Bought a lot of stuff on Amazon.
Yeah, I would have done that.
Yeah, you want to stay away from that REI.
Well.
The mothership.
We get some stuff. I mean, we got some stuff. So we went there and we got the kids' boots.
Yeah.
Now, I got to tell you the funny story about getting the kids' boots. So my boys are close to 8 and 10. Mm-hmm. And they wear size 5 boys, you know, boy shoes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so they're...
Dashiell does too?
Yeah. Well, actually, Dashiell and Peter both now are within like a half a size.
That's funny.
As far as the shoes. So anyways, we go and look, and they got almost what I would say is like infant size shoes. And I'm like, well, where's the boy's selection for boots? Mm-hmm. And she points to these like infant size shoes. And she's like, it's those. I'm like, I'm looking at these things and I can't conceive of these things, you know.
Fitting their feet.
And she's like, well, she's like, I assure you that, you know, we have these in the boys' sizes. But you know, I couldn't.
But they show them off in like a size 2?
What, not even a size 2.
Like a booty.
You're talking like, I don't know.
Like a baby booty.
Well, and that's it. These are like almost like infant size shoes.
Like they do women's shoes to make them look cuter. They show them in women's things. They'll do like a size five and a half or six. And because you're like, oh, that shoe is cute. And then you get that shoe out in your size and you're like, oh, it's like a boat.
And so
how do these clown shoes?
So the shoes on display wouldn't have fit a 3-year-old.
That's weird that they do that.
Let alone an 8 and a 10-year-old boy. With big, big sweaty feet.
So no one would be hiking and wearing that size shoe is what you're trying to say.
Well, it was just simply like when they're trying to sell it, it's like
the display model.
The display model, it's like...
The women's wear philosophy is they show the tinier shoe because every shoe looks great, tinier. Yeah. Like the skinny models. Mm-hmm.
But we're into summer and, you know...
Yeah.
It's just interesting how the tempo changes when the kids don't get on the school bus. The kids stay
different.
The kids stay up later.
Yep.
And I do kind of enjoy it because I get to spend more time with the kids.
It's relaxing.
And I get to spend more time with them in the evening because typically now nobody is up. When I'm leaving for work at 7 or 6:30 in the morning, the dogs and me are the only people up.
Yeah. And the crickets.
Yeah, and the crickets.
And the chickens.
Oh, definitely the chickens.
Of course the chickens.
Oh, we got to get a chicken noise. a rooster noice.
Yeah, a rooster
specifically.
Noise. All right, well, let's...
Louise Candlish, huh?
How about that? Louise Candlish,
ready for
so
it?
Excited. Laura and I spoke with her this morning. Let's get to it. This is our conversation with her. Louise is the author of 13 novels, including Our House.
Wow, I didn't realize she'd written that many novels.
Our House is a number one bestseller. And winner of the British Book Awards 2019 Book of the Year for Crime and Thriller. Her new book is called Those People. Here is Louise Candlish. Really want to talk to you. I love Those People. I loved Our House. And I can't wait to talk to you about them. But first, I have to ask you, there's a big showdown coming up this July. Please tell me, Louise, who is going to walk away with the Wimbledon Championship trophy?
You know I like tennis.
I know you're a big tennis fan. Who do you have?
I'm a huge tennis fan. Well, I suspect Djokovic will win again. I don't want him to win. I would like Roger Federer to win.
Oh, yeah.
And it would just be wonderful for him to have one more. But judging by what happened at the French Open and judging by last year's Wimbledon, I think on grass, if Djokovic's head is in the right place, mm-hmm. I do think he's unbeatable.
Okay, well, you heard it here first. Right, mark it down.
And it's a bit of a safe bet. You know, the number one player in the world. And it is. Well, champion.
Yeah. And he's a good champion. I think, personally, I'm a big Nadal guy, so I think Nadal. I might be going for Nadal. Yes. You know.
Yeah,
I love Nadal, but I think on grass, he's just, I mean, when you think about that semifinal last year with Djokovic.
Insane.
He couldn't have done more than he did.
Yeah.
But on grass, it's just not quite enough. But he was magnificent at the weekend in the French Open. I was crying.
Yeah, that was something else. So you play a lot of tennis too, don't you?
Well, I don't play that much.
No. I'd
like to play a bit more. I'm not that good. I just joined a course called Rusty Rackets, which will tell you everything you need to know about my tennis player.
Oh, that's a delightful name of the club, though, Rusty Rackets. I like that.
Yeah. No.
Well, let's
there
talk.
Are some people on that course who are not that rusty. They're there under false pretenses.
Some ringers in there. Oh, we got to get rid of them. Well, maybe you can loosen up a piece of scaffolding outside the tennis court. Well, let's talk a little bit about Those People. Just a great piece of a suburban noir that you've written along with Our House. What inspired you to write this one?
Well, I think initially it was an experience I had myself with a bad neighbor, although that was a few years ago. It was just always been on my mind as having been, not so much what the bad neighbor did to me, which was really just to be a noisy DIY freak. He was renovating his house and he was doing it unstoppably through the night and, you know, Sunday mornings, and he drove us nuts. But what really intrigued me psychologically was how I responded to this situation. And rather than being a cool and professional sort of person, I was really emotional and really overreacting as if it was the end of the world. And I started to notice that other people did the same when they had, you know, mini conflicts with neighbors. It seemed to encourage this kind of, you know, knee-jerk reactions and, you know, open warfare quite quickly. When I started researching it, I saw that this was very common. And, you know, the speed of escalation would just take your breath away. You know, one moment you think you're having a nice chat over the garden wall, and the next thing, you know, punches are being exchanged and, you know, threats of you know, death threats.
Yeah.
And it's just extraordinary. I was reading only yesterday actually about a street where they have just had a street party to celebrate the departure of one of their neighbors.
Wow.
They were trying to get rid of her for about 5 years. It's just amazing.
And what was
emotions run high, I think, on streets, more than in offices, more than in parks. Just seems to be, there's something about it.
That's true.
Where we're living close by each other, and it's just perhaps a little bit too close for comfort.
Well, yeah. You know, even in the country, though, when you would think they would be fine with plenty of acreage around them, it's still sometimes not enough. It's just humans, I guess, when we get to our safe spot, which is why the suburban noir is really kind of horrifying, because you want to feel safe at home. And
that's right. Yeah. And you're sort of, you feel entitled to feel safe at home. And I
you
think
do.
That's right. I think we do have a human right to have our shelter and to, you know, to have your kids sleeping, you know, in a quiet
peacefully.
Street rather than next to a Megadeth concert. but funny, you should say that even in the country, this is the case, because I don't know if you're aware that here in the UK, Ed Sheeran, the megastar, is embroiled in a huge problem with his neighbours, because he's doing all sorts of things that they disapprove move off. And that's on a great big estate that's known as Sharonville or something.
With all his money. But, you know,
he's built what he says is a pond, and the neighbors think it's a swimming pool. And I just think that we're somehow very watchful and judgmental of each other in the way we live. And we've kind of moved away from a kind of live and let live attitude. And I really wanted to explore that in the book, because really a scenario like the one in Those People should not end with two deaths.
No, that wasn't the resolution of the problem you had with your neighbor, was it?
No. Okay. I had murderous impulses, but I didn't act on them.
Good.
That's the key. Don't act.
Write a novel instead.
Okay, write that down. Don't act. I love it. Well, I really love the way you've turned the victims into the suspects in this book. And there are lots of surprises and twists, not only in Our House, not only in Those People, but also in Our House. Now, is that something that as a writer you set out to do from the get-go, or do these twists and turns just kind of happen organically?
Well, the big ones are plotted from the get-go, because otherwise I just don't think you could sort of do that in an improvised fashion. Mm-hmm. So the plot is loosely mapped out before I start. But some of the smaller ones and some of the smaller tensions, they might arise as I'm writing and as the characters develop. But the big revelations and the big surprises, I know they're coming. And I also know right from the start what kind of an ending there's going to be. And in this case, you know, I kind of knew who was doomed and who might be able to resume a normal life. So it's a mix of plotting and then just being open-minded as the writing goes on, because some of the best ideas do pop up once, you know, when you're in the flow.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And at what point do you start to flesh out the characters? Because I know this was set in England, but I could identify with a lot of the moms. I know that woman. I have been that woman perhaps at some point in my life too.
Yeah.
But did you have these women in particular kind of in your head of like, this is the one who rules the show. She's the one who's going to get the plaque, and she would be the person to display it in her home after she gets the plaque, you know?
Yes, I know. The moms are that come very easily because I'm a mother myself. Yes. I live in a South London neighborhood where I see a lot of this kind of, you know, momagers and alpha moms.
Yeah,
we call them helicopter moms out here.
But and people who have given up incredibly, you know, high achieving careers in order to create a perfect home and a perfect family setup. And I see that happen time and again. So I'm really familiar psychologically with some of the women, it's based on observation. And although I don't set out character studies or anything before I start, but often I've been thinking about the main characters for a while, and so they already feel half real when I start writing, but they do flesh out as I go along. And in some cases, it might take my editor to say, well, he's just a little bit, you know, he's not quite three-dimensional enough. Let's have a look at him. You know, what's his career history? Mm-hmm. Who did he go out with before he married the alpha mom? And so I sometimes with the men, I'll need to go back and do a little bit more work.
Yeah.
They can't all be based on my husband.
As much as he might like that. You don't really, what I love about also these characters that you write about, you don't seem to have a lot of sympathy for them. I mean, you're not afraid to really have your way with them, aren't you?
Yeah.
Well, what I find really interesting about interviews that I do and the response to the book is that some people really think I'm representing these kind of posh families and that I am like that myself.
Oh.
And then other people can kind of, you know, see what it is that I'm doing, which is actually I'm quite critical.
Yeah, and, for sure.
But I'm critical, but I do feel compassion because I do see that nobody's perfect, and it's so easy especially in a high-pressured city life or suburban life, you get whipped up into this frenzy of rivalry and competition and status consciousness. And so it's easily done, and I really do sympathize. But ultimately, both of the books are cautionary tales.
Yeah.
You know, it's saying, come on, let's step back and have a look at ourselves. Do we really want to spend our one precious life having the most beautiful carpeting and the best garden and the nicest trees? You know, let's go out and
enjoy
and have some adventures.
I definitely feel that through your book.
Although walking through a nice shag carpeting and bare feet, you know, there's nothing that can beat that. Now you have a lot of heavy metal references in your book. Now we both enjoy Metallica, particularly their seminal Black album. Now, are you a Metallica fan?
I do. I love Metallica. I say in my acknowledgements.
Yes, I saw that. It's hilarious.
Apologies. Yeah, apologies, because I actually would love to hear
That's
Sad
fantastic.
But True.
Oh, I love that.
Blaring
song.
Through the walls. But not everyone does.
No.
I guess my favorite, though, from that era would be Guns N' Roses.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. For sure.
That's right.
Well, Axl Rose.
You don't agree, obviously.
Well,
Metallica would be a close second, but yeah, I loved the whole LA rock.
How about AC/DC? How about AC/DC?
Oh, I love AC/DC. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. And in fact, I'm trying to think which other bands are mentioned in the book. Possibly AC/DC.
Motorhead. You mentioned Motorhead.
Motorhead. Yeah, I love Motorhead. Yeah, love them all.
Well,
yeah, Ozzy Osbourne's probably in
sure,
there.
Black Sabbath. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's awesome. Now, listen, I actually...
That really is.
I listened to Our House on audiobook and found the readers just absolutely phenomenal. Do you ever listen to your books on audio? Your own books?
Not all the way through. I will listen to bits and pieces. I do have copies, obviously, but because I know the story so well, I don't listen to it all the way through. But I do have a say in the casting. It will be run by me. And but starting with Our House, I would say I started to become, you know, much more involved and interested because audio is booming, as you know, it's absolutely huge. Mm-hmm. And so many people come to my work now through audio in a way that, you know, they never said 5 years ago. So I know it's incredibly important. But also with Our House, because it was partly narrated as a transcribed podcast.
Right.
It felt really important to have particularly the right actor for Fee because she needs to know what she's doing. She's giving an interview, but she has a certain agenda.
She sure
does. It's public, but it's a very private matter. And so it needed to be handled by, you know, a really good actor. So I was much more involved. And then here in the UK, we have our own audio version. So it happens twice.
Really? Yeah.
So in the US, you hire British actors to do it.
Well, you guys are the best.
In a way, you might as well use the ones that
that's weird
in the UK. So it's really interesting.
Yeah, that's a little strange. We're doubling up.
It does seem like a kind of duplication, but actually each set of actors will bring something different and something unique.
Well, now so, you've piqued my interest. I need to find the British version of this audiobook.
Yeah, we actually have just we've just about to start doing the British Those People audio, which is going to be Tuppence Middleton, who I don't know if you know that actress. She's in Downton Abbey, and she'll be in the Downton Abbey movie. So she's a real rising star.
Wow.
So she's a wonderful person to take on Darren and Ralph. And
that's going to be a lot of fun. Is it just going to be one reader?
In the US, it's more complicated with several actors, but in the UK, just all voiced by Tuppence.
Oh.
Well, I guess if you get an actor of that magnitude, you know, let them have at it.
Yeah, I think so. I think both approaches work, actually.
Yeah.
When there's one actor, you can really go on the whole journey with them, and it's very intimate, and it's just you and that one other voice. But then when you have a whole cast of actors, it has that lovely sense that it's more of a dramatization. than a narration. So I really like both approaches, and it's fascinating as the author when, you know, you create this thing on a laptop, just voices in your head,
right?
You know, imaginary friends, and it's lovely to hear them come to life.
When did you, speaking of imaginary friends, when did you first become interested in writing? Were you quite young?
I was, yes. Yeah. When I was about 12, my sister and I were grounded for the summer. Ooh. We were involved in some, you know, sort of petty crime.
Oh, against the neighbors.
And against the neighbors, yeah, no doubt.
Okay, more than that. Yeah. But I was about 12, she's about 13, 14, and we were told we weren't allowed out of the house for the summer, except to go to the unsupervised, I should add. We weren't imprisoned. Mm-hmm. We were allowed to go out with our parents, and we were allowed to go to the library. Oh. And we became very bored, and so we read lots of books, and then we decided we would write one each, and so we started writing novels at that sort of age.
Wow.
Probably lasted a couple of years, and then they were, you know, burned and forgotten about. but later, when I guess I was in my early 30s, when I went back to writing fiction, but I do think that I was helped by having that sort of formative experience. I didn't feel you know, like it was going to be that hard. It proved to be a lot harder than I thought. But when I had my idea for my first novel, I just sort of got on with it, and it all flowed quite nicely. I wasn't scared.
You know, you hear that. You must. That's, you kind of have that in common with. There's different writers that you read about, even going back to Bram Stoker, who was an invalid, and there's that in common where people are forced by some reason to be inside, and they turn to writing.
Yes, I mean that would be such an interesting study, wouldn't it? Because I think there is that sense of, you know, you need to express yourself, and you're being prevented from doing that in other ways, and so you turn inward. But also, I think I have found very much with writing novels that there's an element of therapy to it.
Yeah.
It's really lovely to be able to impose my order on the world. Because, you know, everything's so chaotic and I don't have that much control in real life. And so it's lovely to be, you know, to be the puppeteer in my working life. And they do. Oh, I mean, Nabokov called his characters his galley slaves. And I'm really on board with that. There's a lot of writers. A lot of writers will say that the characters come to life and they write themselves.
Yeah.
But I feel much more like I'm controlling them, or I want to control them.
You really and do I see that
in your writing. Sure. Yeah, I can definitely see that in your writing.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
One quick last question. Now, Our House, great book. Also, a great song by Madness. Did you find yourself singing the song a lot while you're writing? Because I know I sure found myself humming it a lot as I was listening to your book.
A lot of people did, and I wasn't sure if that had been a hit in the U.S., actually.
Oh, massive hit.
No,
actually, it was a bigger hit over here.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
I still remember the video because I love Suggs.
Mm-hmm.
No, I wasn't humming it because it was absolutely the wrong song for the book.
For sure.
I was more likely to be, you know, humming Portishead or something really gloomy, because it's quite a bleak book,
and I think that
Madness was not the right soundtrack for that for the book.
Awesome, very good. Well, Louise, thank you. Appreciate the time.
Thank you so much, and lovely to chat with you both.
Nice to chat with you
too. Nice to
have a great night.
You.
Thank you. Bye.
The Inside Club.
Well, there she was, giving you her picks for Wimbledon, her taste in Metallica. We really covered as much as we could. I could have talked with her for an hour. I really enjoyed that conversation. So thanks to Louise for joining us. We're going to talk about her books in just a little bit, in my recommendation. But first, let's get to...
Oh, you want me to go first?
Laura's with some...
Book reviews!
Sounds good. So I'm going to do another YA novel shout out.
And this is...
Laura Medicus!
A little YA shout out. The old Yasho.
The Yasho. Yeah.
Young adult shout out.
That's right.
Yasho. Get to work on trademarking that one, Andrew, will you? Your business brain.
His business podcast.
Yeah.
So this one, Sylvie really enjoyed. She's read a bunch of her books, or a bunch, I guess.
What's the name of it again?
Other. Haven't said it yet.
All right.
I would say this is, if your daughter, this is a girl book more than a boy book, I would imagine. And if your daughter has liked the To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is a book series and also a movie on Netflix, she would like these books by the author is Maureen Goo, G-O-O, and it's called Somewhere Only We Know. It's brand new, just out, hot off the presses, and Sylvia's read her other two books and really enjoyed them. So they're kind of like romantic comedy.
All right.
Books.
That's our Yasho of the week.
Yeah.
Need to get the girls to record that one.
Oh, yeah. So I did not read a YA novel because
that's not what we do here on
The Inside Flap.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not
I read
that
a book called
wrong with that.
The Healer's Daughter by Charlotte Hinger. I think I'm pronouncing this correctly. So this is an historical fiction novel about a former slave, a young woman named Bethany Hebert, and it's set 12 years after the Civil War. So Bethany is struggling when we first meet her. For some reason, she's taking care of her former mistress, who is a complete mess in the middle of a nervous breakdown. So the white slaveholders and the plantation owners, they lost everything.
Now, this is a novel, correct?
This is, yeah, historical fiction. Okay. Novel. And so this woman is just a mess, like mental breakdown. And Bethany, for some reason, is taking care of her in this rundown house with no money in Kentucky out of some like obligation from her former slave days, even though Bethany is technically free. She is a free woman.
Oh.
And it takes her a while. She's a young woman, and it takes her a while, and probably a lot of former slaves, to get out of that mindset. And there's also not a lot of opportunity for former slaves in the South. So Bethany hears about a black community that sounds like an earthly paradise for a former slave. It's described as a land for the taking. $5, you get a plot of land, there's a river, there's trees, there's verdant farmland, and it's the first all-black community on the Great Plains. And so just to live as a free person among other people with similar life experiences, I mean, it just sounds amazing. Sounds amazing to me to think about.
Yeah, who wouldn't want that? Yeah, sounds like a great, I'd hop on that train right now.
Do you know what town this is, Andrew?
I don't.
Okay. You might have heard of it once I get to it. So after the Civil War, this one white man and a black man, they were going around to black communities in the South, and they were feeding former slaves this beautiful dream of this town in Kansas called Nicodemus. Have you heard of Nicodemus?
I have not. Okay. Although I used to live close to a Nicodemus Road.
Let me tell you.
Okay.
The closest city to Nicodemus is Manhattan, Kansas, and I believe you used to live there.
And unfortunately, I used to live there.
Yes. So this tale,
throw that caveat.
If you can imagine coming out as a slave from the South, and the South is green, it's beautiful. Bethany was from Kentucky with green, verdant fields. I mean, and they're imagining the greenery of the South where you know, you throw something out and it grows, basically. Yeah. So, yeah.
So let me explain why Manhattan, Kansas is where it is. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a few stories.
Oh.
So basically, Manhattan, Kansas is there were some people from back east, and they took a barge or something like that as far as the water could take them.
Uh-huh.
And so basically, the point at which the river started getting so narrow that they couldn't navigate anymore.
They stopped
and said, okay, let's build a town here. So
It's right outside of Topeka. Right.
Probably about an hour.
Oh,
an hour
away.
From Japan. I mean, it's Kansas, so it's still a good distance from there. Now,
you were a few hours then from Nicodemus.
I lived there for about a year, and I will tell you, you know, there's some really nice people in Manhattan, but in terms of living in the town, we found very little enjoyable about it.
Mm-hmm.
So one story is we loved the fall. Cooler weather, spend time outdoors, but they have something called oak mites.
Oh.
And so when oak mites, basically they fall off the trees, but they're microscopic. They burrow into your skin.
You are kidding me.
It's worse than
awful.
So much blood.
Do they itch?
It's worse than a mosquito bite. Do they itch? And
that's terrible.
So you've got this gorgeous fall weather.
But you can't get out of it.
But basically, it's like you cringe at the thought of going outdoors basically because of the oak mites.
It's a hard state. And in the book, she mentions, the writer mentions, that the people are proud that it's a hard state. It's hard to live in with the weather and just the conditions, just the outdoor conditions, especially in the 1870s, which is where this is set.
Yeah, tornadoes. Yes. I mean, you know, yeah. violent storms.
And big winds.
And where we live in Colorado, the mountains are just west of us. Mm-hmm. And what happens is you have these huge storms that come over the mountains, pretty much right where we are. Mm-hmm. And then as the storms go east, the elevation drops.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It opens up to the plains. And so basically, starting from where we live, these storms just build and get bigger and bigger as they cross Kansas. So they...
Nothing to stop them.
No.
And it's just all this mind-numbing heat.
Yeah, that's it. It's the heat. She talks about the heat in this book.
And it just builds as it goes across Kansas. Yeah. But Kansas is, I don't know how to describe it. It's like a steamroller of heat just across the entire...
It's a fiery furnace. Yeah.
But this doesn't sound like the paradise that...
No, so Bethany and these other former slaves, they have nothing left to lose, you know? Some of them are believing what these two men are telling them. Some of them are, like, skeptical.
Yeah.
But they have nowhere else to go. They don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. If you're willing to take a risk, you're going to do it just to try to earn a living and make your way in life as a mm-hmm. free person. So they got their $5 together. They headed west. These people did by wagon, horseback, and foot. Some people walked.
Wow.
Yeah. So many former slaves were leaving that it was called an exodus, and the people were called exodusters, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Exodusters.
Huh. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, too, they arrived, some of them, pretty sick.
Could use a couple of those exodusters around the basement here. I'm looking around. Maybe some inno-dusters also.
Inno-dusters. So what they find, of course, when they arrive in Nicodemus is just devastating. There's a slim, muddy stream. There's no trees. There's grassland for miles and miles. It's incredibly hot. It's dry. It's windy. They've been told there was soft stone in the ground there that they could use to build themselves homes and trees so that they could fell and build, like, timber homes. And there is nothing around to build a house with.
Is there wind?
Nothing.
Wow.
So they ended up being soddies, which is where you create a home in the earth.
Oh, and you live, right.
Yeah.
Sod homes.
A sod home.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
No.
And I mean, also, winter in Kansas is cold. They had little furnace pipes. They would pipe up through the soddy. And I mean, it's just, I can't imagine.
What a horrible existence.
Bone chilling.
Terrible.
I picture it just like a little house in the Shire.
Yeah.
With grass on the roof.
Oh, that sounds nice.
And little round
hobbit
doors.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this book is about the founding of Nicodemus, Kansas, which is the only remaining Western community established by African Americans after the Civil War. So the town is still there. It was a ghost town for a little while. It is still there. The National Park has a free guided tour. It's a park owned by the National Park right now. Huh. I would like to see it sometime.
Yeah, we'll have to check that out.
Driving through Kansas.
When the next time we drive through Kansas.
So this is a grown-up, darkly realistic little house on the prairie. Yet throughout this story, there's hope. So there's a song that people sing throughout the book. Then I think Dave has it. Down by the Riverside. Which
I'm going to lay down.
There you go. Do you know who sings this?
You know, this one I found on...
hang on, let's wait.
Down by the riverside. Down by that river. Down by that riverside. Gonna lay down.
Mm.
Yeah. Really nice.
Grandpa Elliot.
Oh, there you go. And one, I learned a bunch of different things while reading this book, which is partly why I loved it. One of them, too, is the slaves, when they were slaves, they couldn't have drums. They were not allowed to have drums.
Couldn't have drums?
No. And, you know, music is partly
so
how slaves were able to maintain a zest for life, if they had any zest at all.
Sure. Yep.
Any type of hope was through music in their community. And not allowed to have drums. So in this book, of course, the men of the town make drums and use the drums. They thought that the slaves would start communicating with one another via drums.
Because that makes sense.
And rise up.
Sure.
which is a constant fear if you're a slaveholder. There you go. So these people, they build sod houses, they create a school for their children. They do encounter the Osage Indian tribe.
Oh.
Who, as a side note, the Osage are experiencing their own apocalypse, basically, at the hands of black and white people. White and black people. Mm. Doesn't matter to the Osage Indian. They view white and blacks
sure,
as
it's all
the same
to them.
Yeah. There's also other white people who are struggling to survive in this barren Great Plains of Kansas. They're all kind of in it together, and they have to help one another. So Bethany is a strong female character. She's educated. She also had learned when she was on the plantation how to treat illnesses, assist women with childbirth. Hence the name. It's called the Healer's Daughter. Her mother was a healer. So it's all things kind of associated with health. So she becomes a valuable member of the community.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another book. If you're pregnant...
Oh, don't read it?
You can read it. You are going to need to skim through a few things in this book.
All right.
Also, if I ever have to go back in time, like I land on one of those standing stones and I get sucked back into time, I don't want to go to the Great Plains, Kansas in the 1870s.
No, it sounds like
you don't want to go there in 2019,
let alone back then.
I would like to not go there. So I highly recommend this book. It's a fascinating look at a few different things from our American past, slaves, what happened to them immediately after the Civil War, which is fascinating. It was laid out in a really interesting way here. And then the Great Surge Westward, and what it was like for early pioneers, women and men alike.
Mm-hmm. So I looked on the map, and Nicodemus is well west of Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
It is near. In between Hayes and Colby.
Yeah, Hayes is there.
And
yeah.
There is nothing,
nothing there.
I mean, absolutely nothing there.
No. Mm. Yeah, I just can't imagine coming there and being fed these lies by these people that this is, you know, your promised land.
Sounds like their own personal Indian reservation.
Yeah. They make it their own, though. It is better. It is better than a reservation, though. I'd say that. That's for sure. So this is just great. This woman... you know, she wrote that nonfiction book that I had said before on this subject first, and then she just used her knowledge to craft an entertaining fiction novel about, you know, this group of Westerners that, you know, we don't talk about, we don't know much about them, and it's an interesting part of our history.
Cool. And the name of that book was?
The Healer's Daughter by Charlotte Hinger.
And that was reviewed by...
Laura Medicus!
Sounds good. I always do enjoy historical fiction, especially set in the West, you know, just like The Hunger.
I think I'm a new historical fiction gal.
I think that's
me.
I am
historical fiction right now. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
It's weird, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's weird. I mean, I go through phases.
Yeah.
I think it's weird.
Well,
it's not weird.
But it's weird.
But growing up, there was a time when that's all I read was historical fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I read biographies, autobiographies, historical fiction.
Well, I know we were forced to read historical fiction in high school, as we documented earlier.
And for some reason, I actually sought it out. Now, I do have a thought for you.
Yeah.
I have the kind of mind that every once in a while, it's like I hit my head. And I come up.
Some might say he's been hit in the head one too many times.
Maybe. Yeah. And so I'm sitting there thinking of the word novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a novel concept.
Yes. And and you think about that and you wonder, well, what is the derivation of the term novel? You know, I just wonder it must be. I mean, there has to be something that happened.
From Latin novella, meaning new things.
Yeah. It's fascinating for the podcast. Things we don't know. That's
things
my podcast.
That's
I've
Laura's
always
podcast.
Wanted to do a podcast called Things I Don't Know. Then I would have it set up. So I talk about a topic where I kind of knew a little bit about it, but there's a lot I don't know, which is pretty much every topic. Like we could take cricket, for example. And then I'd like to take calls in the community, and then we could all wildly speculate about that topic.
Yep.
So Dave... You have a book for us, don't you?
I do. And you know what? It's called Those People and is written by Louise Candlish.
Yeah.
So I am. Now, this is her latest book, but it's out today, as I said before. So definitely run out and get this book right now. But only get it if you are a fan of brilliantly written, perfectly plotted, deliciously wicked thrillers with some equally wicked twists and turns. So go out and get it. But only if you're a fan of those things. Now, this book has been described as a suburban noir, and that dares to ask the question, could you hate your neighbor enough to kill him? So that is the question that is posed in this book. The neighbor in question in this book is Darren Booth. Now, he moves into the house at the end of a delightful block full of charming neighbors where they shut the street down every Sunday and kids can go into the street and ride their bikes up and down the street. And they can play hopscotch there. And
Sounds idyllic.
A lady runs a charming little B&B and brothers live in harmony side by side. And by golly, all is fine. And isn't life grand in their little slice of upscale
suburban
heaven? Until Darren Booth. So this guy, Darren Booth, moves in to the one house at the end of the street, and he does all the kinds of foul things that you can imagine any bad neighbor would do. He plays music at all hours of the day and night. He plays it very, very loudly. He parks his motley collection of cars and RVs up and down the street, and he bangs and he clangs while working on renovations to his house at all hours of the day and night.
Sounds like a combination of Andrew and you.
That's right, Andrew with his RV, me with my banging and my clanging.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he basically shatters the lives of these suburbanites.
I bet.
Just like the skull of he or she who will not be named in this recommendation that is right. Someone in this book gets their skull crushed. So instantly does he drive a wedge between himself and his neighbors that, like cracks and fissures, that kind of emanates from this wedge. They worm themselves into the relationships that the neighbors have with each other, with their wives, and with their husbands. So, we're all kind of jamming out to this Metallica right now.
Hey, I'm waiting for Hetfield to start singing here.
Well, it has a very long introduction.
I had no idea. The intro was so long.
Enter Sandman.
It did a long talk up. Oops.
There we go. Or I just stepped on it.
All right, there he is.
So you find out on the very first page that someone has died on the street, but you do not know who. Mm-hmm. And now she's structured this novel in a very interesting way.
I started the novel. I haven't finished yet. And
yeah,
it's
Lars reading
really
it right
well
now.
Done.
So each succeeding chapter in the first half of the book starts out with a different character. Each one is a resident of the street, and it is starts out with a transcript of what they've told the police about this murder. Mm. Now, right after that little transcript, it flashes back to weeks earlier. And with each new chapter, we get a week closer to the actual incident, and we get little clues as to who might have done it and why it might have happened. So this is a locked room mystery. I would call this a locked street mystery. It's cool. A really fun whodunit, but it's not done in the tradition of any whodunits. I found it to be reminiscent in tone, which is really, really mm-hmm. dark, to a number of Thomas Berger's books. I'm a big fan of Thomas Berger. And if you guys have ever read The Feud or Meeting Evil mm-hmm. or Neighbors, which they made into just a terrible movie with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. But it's basically the setup where a peaceful, harmonic suburban existence can be completely uprooted with this one single variable. Now, one thing I really like about this book is that you know these characters are all just pawns in an evil game that Candlish is playing, as we talked about in the interview. And I could almost literally hear her cackling when something terrible happens to one of her characters and awful things do happen to them. Mm-hmm. Or, as she said in her interview, she basically called these characters her puppets, since she does consider herself to be a puppeteer. But I feel like she would... she'd use those puppet strings as nooses for these characters if she could.
Kind of a satire, too, because it is kind of funny.
The
descriptions of the women, like I told her.
Yeah.
Like some of them I could identify with, and I felt kind of bad that I identified with that.
These are all people you know.
And then other parts, I'm like, yep, that's that lady.
These are all people that you might be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
like some of it's a little uncomfortable because you're like, oh, I've done that before. Mm-hmm.
And so what happens to all these characters, they get backed into corners, you know, where they mm-hmm. find their tidy little lives disrupted by this annoying creature. And now they must ask themselves, what do they do?
Yeah.
So there's murder in this book. There is a constant police presence. Secrets are withheld and whispered. Jealousy and, of course, rage, as many of these characters pleasantly picture the different ways in which they would kill poor old Darren Booth. Now, I noticed there's something interesting about the main characters, I guess the antagonist named Darren Booth.
Uh-huh.
His initials, of course, are DB. Now, I didn't know if she meant to call him a douchebag.
Oh.
Because he definitely is one. So I don't know if there was something
I don't
she
know
gave
that the
him.
Brits.
Intentional. Yeah.
I don't know if the Brits say that. Do they say that, British?
I saw a douchebag. I don't think they
call
do.
Call Louise up and ask her.
We need to call her, get her back, yeah. Skype her back. And
dirtbag. Dirtbag.
And I'll tell you this is there are some British adjectives I could use right here. But I know that, like, if we said those in the U.S., we would think, oh, you know, that's not a bad word.
Yeah.
But I know across the pond,
yeah,
if we said some of those words, I mean, they would be like saying
right, that's
a bad
true,
word
yeah.
here.
A bad word here. Yeah. So I will not. I would love listening to an audiobook of this because
funny you mentioned that.
Because yeah. I could hear the British accents and things like that. Uh-huh. Now, of course, I have to tell you a story. I worked overseas.
Yes.
And I spent a lot of time in Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
And I especially spent a lot of time in Scotland. But I remember one time after work, I was like walking around the streets of Scotland. And I remember there were these two old women. And basically, they could barely walk. The ladies were going for a walk. And they could have been 80, you know.
95-year-old. Yeah.
And so I remember the ladies were waiting for their friend to come along. And I just remember in this Scottish accent,
uh-huh.
so thick that you could barely understand it.
Yeah.
And I just remember, I still remember the humor. And it's like, oh, here comes old Madge, as spry as ever. I mean, this woman can barely walk.
That's funny. Were they joking at all?
Oh, of course they were.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That book, of course, is called Those People by Louise Candless, reviewed by
Dave Medicus.
Andrew, you got a book for us? Perhaps?
I do, and let's see if you're paying attention.
Oh, dear.
We're always paying attention.
So I'm reviewing a book by Lawrence P. White.
Okay, well, you just did this last week, The Ship's Log.
Yep, and so basically, I'm reviewing the third...
Do I get a ding, Dave?
Yeah, I'm reviewing a third book in the series. It's a good thing we didn't go head-to-head with Laura for trivia. That's what we need to do, is a Dave okay. Medicus, Laura Medicus.
Oh, sure.
We can try it.
That's right.
Head-to-head trivia. I need to make that. I need to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. You do.
Might keep things interesting in the Medicus household for a while.
He kills me on those things,
We're going to work on it.
There are certain games that the family, like Sylvia and I, we don't even play with them because it's not
this
fun.
This is true.
We can do interior decorating trivia.
I like that. Yeah. Thanks, Andrew. Yeah. Let's do that.
Let's name eight different styles of brickwork.
Lattice, mortar,
straight set, brick set,
bricks to the head,
herringbone,
brick to the groin.
Okay, I think we might be on to something here. So
blockhead.
So the reason I did this review is mm-hmm. basically I read the first book
mm-hmm.
and
Ship's Log,
and then two more books have been published in the series mm-hmm. since I, you know, years ago since I read the first book.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And so I read the second book and I read the third book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as I read these books, each book got significantly better than the book before.
Cool.
Oh, that's always fun.
That's what you hope. Yeah, as a reader.
Rare is the instance where that happens.
Well, and I think that...
Although I would say CJ Box, book number 19, still just as strong as ever.
I think it can happen, but I think there's sometimes like a slump in like the third, yeah. mm-hmm. sometimes second or third.
Well, I think especially when you look at somebody who's writing as a second career,
mm-hmm.
To me, it's really great to watch them grow as an author. And I could tell there's something special about Lawrence in the first book. Mm. I mean, I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And so the first book was only 195 pages.
Delectable.
Series, yep, yeah. Delectable. And the series is called The Alliance.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And the second book is called Conception, which is 259 tantalizing pages.
Mm.
And then, of course, the third book, Genesis, which I'm reviewing this week.
All right.
Is 362
glorious pages
of science fiction. And so as I'm reading these books, you know, the plot gets thicker, the character development gets better, the descriptions of science and technology gets better.
Just beat out Louise Cow. I was just checking the Candlish novel. Those People clocks in at a sprightly 355 pages.
Okay. Oh. Yep.
Okay.
Well-paced, I should say. It read like it was 10
pages.
This
is Andrew's book review.
Yeah. Stand down.
Stand down. So sorry.
And so, it wasn't just my perspective. So I went on Goodreads and I looked at the ratings. Uh-huh. And so the first book came in at 4.23. Mm-hmm. You know, decent.
Oh, that's really
decent. That's really high.
High.
Yep.
Very high.
The second book, Conception, came in at 4.45.
Wow.
And the third book came in at 4.6.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man.
You know, I will say, though, in a series of books, what you will see is the first book is usually ranked lower because it's a wide mass of people reading it, and then people will drop off.
And that's true.
The ones who stick around because they like it already, and they're more likely to give it a better review, just what I've seen.
Yeah, and that's I can see that because... Because
I've gotten fooled on some of those where I'm just going to pick the highest rated book of that series. And I maybe necessarily shouldn't have done that.
Well, and I think a good indication here then is looking from the second to the third book, the fact that you still see considerable improvement. And I said, I really enjoyed it. The first book to me was a pretty straightforward story. Mm-hmm. The second part, you could see the complexity developing, but the book is called The Alliance, and the third book, Genesis, is really about building the alliance. So the whole series really culminates in the third book. So
he got a nice picture on his Goodreads
page. He looks like Sully.
He's so happy.
He looks like Sully.
Yeah, he's Sully. This guy is Sully.
He's a pilot, as we talked about, in Vietnam. I think he flew, 600...
600 missions. Well, he's flown for the military commercially for 49 years.
Looks like
so
Sully.
Happy to be behind the wheels of that plane.
Now here's a question for you.
Are you behind a wheel on a plane?
I don't know. It's like a tank. You drive it like a tank.
Yeah. If somebody's been a pilot for nearly 50 years, 5 decades.
Wow.
And he writes a book about UFOs.
I know.
Is there something?
We talked about that last week.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Inspired to writing.
The ones off the coast.
So the book Genesis is all about the Alliance. And so the first book is about the UFO encounter, the discovery. Mm-hmm. The second book, Conception, basically...
Oh, that's right. These are the boneless, happy,
Greg,
the lucky ones.
Greg, yeah. Yep. The Greg Hamilton wakes up and he's recuperating. But it's really all about discovering the difference between humans and the entity. And it's Greg basically being accepted in this world and finding a place. Hmm. The third book starts out, and it starts out at a point where you start to learn a lot more, and everything starts to get pieced together. And Greg has the job of building the alliance, right? And the entity know that they don't have as they say, they can't pull the trigger. Hmm. They can fly ships like nobody else. They're smart. They're creative. They're kind. Mm-hmm. They are scientists. I mean, they love science. They love knowledge. But simply, they would not take a life even to save their own. Hmm. And the book recognizes that, and it appreciates that in them. But it knows that in order for this race to survive, they're going to have to change. And one way they don't have to change is they bring the humans come in, and the humans step in to a certain extent to take, an aggressive role, something that we're accustomed to because we have a history of wars and battle. And we do not, obviously, we don't have a problem pulling the trigger if we're threatened.
Yeah.
And so, and this book talks about the Alliance, but it talks about, it's three different cultures, it's three different species. And it talks about, how can we build a society that could extend 500 or 1,000 years in the future to really help, provide a safe galaxy for the current races, but also if we discover new races. And the races are it's the Anatee, who are the super advanced...
Kind
aliens, but they are naive and they are just too peace-loving. Hmm. Then you have the Harbokh, which are these warriors that we find out that they've been fighting a battle for over 2,000 years. And they've been fighting this battle for so long that they don't remember their civilization.
Wow.
They don't remember their civilization back from before. Hmm. And they give some thoughts in this book that if the war actually ends, what will you do? How will it change you? Mm-hmm. And those are good questions.
Yeah.
But it's, It's what I like about the book is it's deep, it's sophisticated, it's thought-provoking. You've got contrasts of all these different species. And, of course, you've got the humans who are creative, and we are really the glue that basically makes the alliance work, that basically ties everything together. Now, this book also has
the twist.
And not just one.
Uh-oh.
We need to find a Jack Black quote where he talks about twists.
Yeah.
Because are a few twists in this book. Maybe even three or four.
I do love some twists.
But the book is, there's at times you think things are hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
Then things actually start coming together. Mm. And the way this third book is written, it is written very artfully, where these things really happen naturally. I mean, it's not like, oh, it's forcing this to happen. I mean, it's like, okay, this happens. It's a chance encounter, and it fits in. But I mean, this I really love this series. I love the third book, Genesis in this series. But there's science. They talk about space travel.
Mm.
They talk about researching and discover and, you know, using the scientific method to improve upon the space travel. And there's a few scientific breakthroughs that happen in this book that if those scientific breakthroughs did not happen, it did not occur.
Hmm.
Those things are what made the difference. Let's say in being able to have the outcome that the final book had. And it really is, there's parts of this book that are terrifying. It is an amazing end to the Alliance series.
It's a trilogy then.
Yes, it is. So no, seven books and nine books. And I have to say,
it looks like he's written another series, the Spirit of Empire series. It looks like only four books there. Five book series.
Yeah, and I've actually read at least two of the Spirit of Empire books.
Oh.
So maybe I'll review those on a different.
Where'd you discover this guy?
Kindle.
Yeah.
This is the book is Genesis.
Yes.
By Lawrence P. White.
Mm-hmm.
And I highly recommend it.
All right. And
cool.
That was recommended by
Andrew Dowd.
Cool. Very good. Sounds good. We'll let old Lawrence P. White know. Back to back weeks of, that's a first. All right. So let's get to it. It is time now for our
audiobook of the week.
So, of course, I'm going to talk about Our House by Louise Candlish. So, this is the book that dares to ask this question. What would you do if you came home from a weekend getaway and another family was moving all their stuff into your house? This is the position that Fiona Lawson finds herself in, and this is how the book starts. From there, we go back in time, and the book flashes back and forth from this moment going forward and to the past. So just like in those people, she employs different techniques in her method of storytelling. So it's told in a very unique way. We get to hear from the perspectives of both Fiona and her husband, from whom she is separated, Bram. Now, Fiona tells much of her story through a podcast.
Bram Stoker?
Bram, no, short for Abraham, not Bram Stoker, right?
I think it's pronounced Bram, actually.
If you're British?
Bram Stoker? Bram?
I know. When
we heard Jeff Strand say Bram.
Yeah, but when I was listening to the Dracul book, they would pronounce
you're
it
right,
Bram.
You're right, they did.
I listened to it.
Andrew has
they all said Bram.
This goes back to my idea of last week.
Oh, it was.
That's right.
You're right, with Maggie. Yeah.
That there
we
should
need
be,
to know.
There should be a website where authors can provide the pronunciation of nouns so that we do not butcher them.
But it's funny because I was just... There's an Irish book I read, and there's a lot of Irish names in there, and I looked it up online. This author, she created a video. She's got the names of her characters on little pieces of paper, and she tells you how to pronounce them.
So she
stole your idea.
And who did that?
Irish author. What's her name? I just read her book called The Ruin. Really good book.
You're going to talk about it next week, probably.
I might talk about it next week, so we'll just put that on the kibosh.
I think I reviewed a book, Alien Ruins. Remember that?
I remember that.
That's right.
David?
No. Huh? What?
David?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. Right.
Wow, did that fall flat.
Yes, Andrew found
the button.
Found the button. All right, so Fiona, she tells her story through a podcast called The Victim. And after each episode, you get tweets from the listeners as they sympathize with Fiona's plight or, and more often than not, kind of disparage her because that, let's face it, is what people on Twitter do. So it's kind of fun how she incorporates the, it's almost like it's the reader yelling at the character, but she does it in the way and through tweets. So it's like she's saying what you're thinking. Now, Bram's story is told in first person through a Word document that he is writing. Now, the readers are great. The audiobook narrators, Elizabeth Nolden and Elliot Hill. In particular, there's a rather unsavory character in the book that I think Elliot has a lot of fun with. Now, this is a story about property fraud and pretty much lays out how... So, Andrew, if you wanted to steal someone's house, I think you could read this novel and figure out exactly how to do it. I don't want to give away too many of the plot points because this is a wild, crazy ride that Candlish takes you on, and the fun of it is in the getting there. It all starts out with a very minor plot point that gets dropped when we find out that Bram has a problem. He likes to speed, and he's received a few speeding tickets. It doesn't sound too... unsavory. However, the whole story unravels from there, and when it unravels, it all comes undone from Bram, but especially for Fiona, the unwitting innocent in all of this, as they are separating because Bram cheated on her in their kid's playhouse in the backyard of all places.
Details.
And now forces of nature are conspiring against her. Let's listen to a clip.
She must be mistaken, but it looks exactly as if someone is moving into her house. The van is parked halfway down Trinity Avenue, its square mouth agape, a large piece of furniture sliding down the ribbed metal tongue. Fee watches, squinting into the buttery sunlight, rare for the time of year, a gift, as the object is borne shoulder high by two men through the gate and down the path. My gate. My path. No, that's illogical. Of course it can't be her house. It must be the Reese's, two down from hers. They put their place on the market in the autumn, and no one is quite sure whether a sale has gone through. The houses on this side of Trinity Avenue are all built the same. Red brick, double-fronted Edwardians in pairs, their owners united in a preference for front doors painted black, and everyone agrees it's easy to miscount.
This is wicked, delightfully so. Now, I just kind of love the way it's kind of like a mousetrap, how these characters get ensnared into everything that's going, revolving around them. And it's really a lot of fun to watch it all play out and watching all the pieces fall apart. Highly recommended. This is called Our House. And, of course, not to be confused with the Madness song, Our House. This is Louise Candlish's Our House. And
nice.
That is your
audiobook of the week.
Give a listen. I'm still upset that there is a British version of the audiobook. I had no idea.
Yeah, Andrew? This is something funny that Louise told
us in the interview. Two versions of the audiobook.
I don't know why we're saying this now, since it's going to be...
Two different versions.
You know, it's
one for the Brits and one for us.
Yeah, and they're all British readers, though.
They're all British narrators.
So you wonder what's the difference?
Exactly. I got to know what is the difference.
Hey, we are having J.D. Barker on next episode.
Oh, so we can ask him how he can pronounce.
We'll find out. Yeah.
All right.
Looking forward to him.
Yeah, that'll be a lot of fun. J.D. Barker coming up for you next week. Thank you so much to Louise Candlish for joining us. We enjoyed.
Let's go Federer.
Let's go Nadal.
Actually,
yes.
Nadal. I'd rather see Nadal.
Yeah, but Louise will be rooting for Federer in Wimbledon, of course. That's our show for this week. Please, please, please tell a friend. Subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you're listening to us. We will talk to you next week. My name is Dave Medicus. I really appreciate you listening to us.
The underlying message of the neighborhood is that if somebody cares about you, it's possible that you'll care about others.
Fred Rogers.
Mm. Oh. Keyword is possible.
Yeah.
Bye.
Interesting.
We recommend The Healer's Daughter by Charlotte Hinger, Genesis by Lawrence P. White, Those People by Louise Candlish. Audiobook is Our House by Louise Candlish, narrated by Elizabeth Nolden and Elliot Hill.
I have the kind of mind that every once in a while it's like I hit my head.